Welcome to Discovery's podcast. We're glad you're joining us today. If you'd like to know more about us, you can check out our website, dc2.me, or follow along on our socials. And now, here is this week's sermon.
Well, good morning, Discovery Church. My name is Jake, and I'm one of the pastors here. And man, today feels heavy to me. I'm going to name that. I don't know if it feels heavy for you. Killings in North Carolina, Utah, Evergreen, Dallas, a notable public figure, kids in Evergreen, a young woman riding on a train. This week feels heavy. As a parent, this week feels heavy. And I want to acknowledge that this heaviness isn't felt the same by everyone here. But I know there are many walking in today feeling on edge, feeling heartbroken, feeling numb, feeling angry, feeling irritated, feeling lost. And for many of us, we still show up with a smile because that's what's expected. Because when you show up in public, you show up with a smile. Whether it's because we don't even know how or want to talk about it, we don't know who's safe to talk to, we just want to get through the day, and why, oh why, is this guy on stage even talking about this? It's all I've been hearing. I get it. Oh man, I get it. And today's message, while timely in my opinion, is actually going to ask us to move into that heaviness just a little. Really, I'm going to be asking us to look at how we respond in the midst of junk, especially when it comes to other people. This message has been on the books for about a year now, and I've been prepping it for about 3 months, so it isn't a reaction, but rather I think it's a true gift from God to us. Today we're in week 2 of our catchphrase series, The Things We Say Around Here. Last week, Zach brought us, no matter what you've done or what's been done to you, you're welcome here, which is a big one around here. It's a reminder that no matter what you've done, no matter what life choices you've made, no matter what life choices were made for you without your permission, no matter where you are today, you are welcome here. Hard stop. And today is a pretty natural follow-up to that as we talk about one of our most used phrases and ideologies. Here at Discovery, you can belong before you believe. And before we go too far with that and really dive into the nuts and bolts, I'd like to jump into Scripture and read a fun story that's going to inform some of what we talk about today. If you're someone who likes to follow along in a Bible, we'll read this again later as well if you want to bookmark it. This will be in Luke 19, 1 through 10. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor, and if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will gladly pay back 4 times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost." Here at Discovery, you can belong before you believe. And there's a third word I'm going to add to it that, depending on your wiring or your background or your inclinations, is going to make you squirm and maybe feel instantly on edge. And that word is behave. You can belong before you believe, and there's a component of behavior we're going to talk about as well. And to get ahead of it, those first two words, belong and believe, have very active components, while around here, that third word tends to come oftentimes as a result of the first two. I'll explain more as we go. You see, every organization, every business, every group that meets uses these three words, whether they know it or not. And it's not just that they use these words. Every organization, every business, every group orders these words based on what they're trying to accomplish. Let me explain. When I go to the airport, when I'm walking through security, when I'm going to my plane, I order these words: behave, belong, believe. It's not really important to me if you think your liquid should make it through security. I would just prefer security to be an easier walk. I don't actually really care what seat you think you should be in. I just want to go to my seat. I'm not that interested in what you think about smoke detectors in the airplane. I just don't want you to smoke because I want to go to my seat. I want to put my headphones in. I want to fall asleep, and I want to get to my destination safely. For me, when it comes to airports and airplanes, behavior matters a lot. And belonging does too. I want people to be able to go get on an airplane. I want people to belong. I want them to be safe. But when it comes to airports, belief is a pretty distant third for me. This ordering is used in restaurants, fraternities, political parties, colleges, sports teams, the line at the supermarket, how you choose to drive, how you post online, how you talk to people in every area of your life. We tend to order these words in different ways in different areas. In some areas, the behavior you show is the most important step. In others, the belief you hold are vital for that place. And in others, belonging matters most. So why does Discovery order ours the way that we do? And what does that gain us? And this is so important, and we're going to talk more and more about this. By choosing to say belong before you believe, we are choosing discomfort. We are choosing some lack of clarity, and we are probably choosing some conflict. Back in 2006, I took a job at a nonprofit for high-risk youth, one of my favorite jobs. So we had this goal of reaching out to latchkey kids, kids whose parents worked, and so kids went home to an empty house, and kids with IEPs and LAPs. An IEP is an individualized education plan. This is pretty normal. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with a kid. It oftentimes means that there's some sort of catch-up in some area. But we generally pursued kids who had IEPs that were behavioral in nature. So if you think back to a class that has the one or two kids that really were disruptive, back in 2006, we partnered with Adams 12 to bring about 60 or 70 of them into a program. It was fun, and it was interesting, and it was hard. Most of these kids had behavioral issues, home issues, language issues. About 80% of who we worked with were migrant and immigrant families, and it was one of the most fun jobs I've ever had. These were kids who, some of them were years behind in school. There were kids here who just fought and acted out. I remember a day we were meeting out of an old alternative high school, and a Thornton City police officer came by to drop off some paperwork to the alternative high school. And he walks into our organization, and he freezes at the front door, and he just kind of stares. And after about 20 seconds, I see him standing there, and so I walk up, and I say, "Hey, I'm Jake. Is everything okay?" And he looks at me and he says, "I know about 8 of the kids in here." And I go, "Okay. Is everything okay?" And he looks at me like I obviously missed something, and he says, "I know like 8 of these kids." It took me a minute to get caught up. He wasn't a student resource officer. He didn't primarily work with schools, and he recognized 8 of the students we were working with. He asked me what we were doing, and I said, "Oh, we're an after-school program. I think we're doing math homework right now." He had no idea how to respond. We kind of made a little bit of small talk, and he dropped off the paperwork and left. Our kids fought a lot. There were issues with violence. There were issues with drugs. There were issues with the police. There were kids showing up whose parents hadn't been home for a couple days. There were kids going through the day not eating. These kids had it tough. Their behavior was rough. Honestly, at that time in my life, being a big guy was helpful because there was some physicality needed just for safety, and we wanted to make sure these kids belonged, that they had a home, that they had a place to unwind, that they had a place to get a meal, that they had a place to be seen and heard, that they had a place to laugh and cry. Their behavior was rough, and we wanted to make sure they knew they belonged. Their beliefs, we'll come back to those later. 2 years into working there, I got a job here at Discovery, and I was working both jobs at once. To say it was a culture shock was the understatement of the year. I jumped in with our group, youth group, with a group of middle school boys, and their behavior was incredible. Say whatever jokes you want to say about middle school boys, these were good kids. They had their own junk, and there were occasional rough times, but to be honest, the worst I ever saw here was better than some of the best days at my other job. The kids here were well behaved, and they knew they belonged. They had connection, and they had relationship. And to be honest, I struggled a lot early on here because the kids here just seemed to have it all together. Their lives were good. They were fine. They were about perfect. And I wondered at the need for someone like me in student ministry because these kids and their families seemed to have it all figured out. I know now, looking back, that what my student ministry was experiencing is some of what I'm going to refer to today as the curse of the suburbs. But it was a journey figuring some of this out, and it's precisely that we're talking about today. All right, put a pin in those two groups. We're going to come back to them later, especially when it comes to matters of belief. Belong before you believe. What does that look like? Well, looking at Jesus's life, we have a rabbi who taught. We know that he taught in the synagogue. We can find this in Luke 4, 14 through 17. Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about him spread throughout the whole countryside. He was teaching in their synagogues, and everyone praised him. He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day, he went to the synagogue, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. So we know that in the synagogue, not only did Jesus teach, but it wasn't just parables, it wasn't just stories. He taught from the Old Testament, in this case, the scroll of Isaiah. We know that the Sabbath, it was his custom to be in the synagogue. And a question I would have for everyone here today who knows the stories of Jesus is how many of the stories come to mind quickly that happened in a synagogue or a place of formal worship, and how many happened elsewhere? In the synagogue, we see stories like Jesus casting out demons, Jesus teaching, Jesus healing. There's somewhere between 8 or 10 times we see reference to this. These teachings were both evangelistic and discipleship-oriented in nature. They pointed people to a relationship with God they might not know, and they pointed followers of God to go deeper in relationship with him. And then we have these other times with Jesus. These times we see him walking around the countryside and healing the sick, bringing sight to the blind, preaching, eating with Jewish leaders, performing miracles for Romans, connecting with Samaritans, connecting with Gentiles, discipling and bringing the gospel to a hurting world. Jesus' ministry and his stories are so diverse. They mix in and out of evangelism and discipleship. They point to those distant from God, and they invite him to experience the fullness of their Creator. And they point to those who should be walking with God, and they invite him into true depth. And throughout Jesus' stories and miracles, he is constantly pointing to everyone around him with a statement, "You belong." And for some, the people I spoke to and told that you belong, your beliefs are already coming into alignment with mine. Let me show you how to go deeper. And for others whose beliefs were not in alignment and were in the midst of sin and were broken, he would say, "You still belong." He never shied away from truth while always keeping a wide open front door. And what's fun about this is that Jesus wasn't just a one-trick pony. He didn't appeal to just one group. He had a message and an approach that brought life to everyone around him, and the groups he connected with were diverse. And in that, we come to a tension that arises when you espouse a theological philosophy of belong before you believe. In this room, we are not all the same. We currently live in a tumultuous time. In this room, we have people on both sides of almost every major social issue. We are not politically homogenous. We come from different backgrounds, different theologies, different faith traditions. We carry different levels of belief, trauma, and current junk we're going through. On any given day, you might be sitting next to someone who really is starting to get their life together or may have quite a bit figured out, or you may be sitting next to someone who is really falling apart but with a smile on their face. The curse of the suburbs. It's pretty important to look like everything's okay and look like everyone else. And Jesus lived in a more socially, spiritually, and politically tumultuous time than we do today. See, Jesus had relationships with Jews, Gentiles, Romans, Greeks, Samaritans, men, women, sick, and healthy. Except to put people in just those categories is really disingenuous, just like it's disingenuous to say Christians. You see, Jews were a subjugated and oppressed people who were a mix of the highly spiritual, the politically focused, those done with society and off on their own, those violently opposed to the current political regime, those who had thrown in with the current political regime, those who were just trying to breathe and get by, those who were barely making it. Jesus spoke to all of them. The Romans were a mix of those in extreme power. We hear all about Herod and Caesar and Pilate, the people who set policy and whose policy feels like the word of God that people follow. And then we see the soldiers and the centurions and the citizens, those who are in the ruling group, but effectively are also just following some of those same orders. Jesus had his interactions with both sets of groups. We have the Gentiles and the Greeks. Those were a part of societies that had been swallowed up by the Roman Empire. There were groups like the Greeks, the Syrians, the Phoenicians, the Egyptians, the Samaritans, the Nabataeans. And Jesus walked the cultural lines talking with all of them. And in some of them, there's this beautiful connection, saying our people have a history together and there are beautiful shared talking points. And then others, hey, our people have a history together and it's not good. Our people have been fighting for a long time, and Jesus walked the line to talk with all of them. I can only assume Jesus had his share fair of people just upset with what his people had done. He spoke with men, those who were societally more allowable for him, a male Jewish rabbi to speak to, and he spoke to women, those at the time who had less power and whose interaction was far more taboo. He spoke with those in power, those who were doing well, and those who were just getting by, and those who were falling apart. And he spoke to the sick, and he spoke to the healthy. And to one group, he offered a relationship with his Father and a spiritual healing that would affect the rest of their lives. And to the other, he offered a relationship with his Father and a spiritual healing that would affect the rest of their lives, because both groups were in such need of healing and relationship with God. In this, Jesus spoke to those who were deeply chasing God, right alongside those who were in the throes of sin. He spoke to rabbis, and he spoke to those thrown at his feet, caught in the act of adultery. And in all these cases, he pointed toward belonging and relationship with his Father. Jesus practiced an approach wherein, by his very nature, he was constantly evangelizing, pointing people to a God who loved them. And in the next line, he was constantly discipling, pointing people toward a deeper relationship with his Father. He constantly challenged both groups into a deepening and burgeoning relationship with a God who loved them. With all this in mind, and the blurred lines between evangelism and discipleship, I think it'd be a lot of fun to go back to that story from Luke 19 one more time. Pay attention to Jesus's inherently evangelistic tone. You are welcome into a relationship with my Father. Pay attention to Jesus's inherently discipleship-oriented tone. There are next steps in your relationship to go deeper with God. And pay attention to Jesus's use of behavioral language. To be clear, he's talking to a liar and a cheater who admits it. And let's see how Jesus interacts. Luke 19, once more, 1 through 10. Jesus entered Jericho and was walking through. A man there was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming his way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He has gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. But the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost." Zacchaeus' behavior was not good. When he comes and says he's going to give half his money away and he's going to give four times what was cheated, those were not just throwaway statements. There were people in that crowd who were lied to and cheated by this man. Zacchaeus had made some poor and hurtful choices that affected the people around him. And when it came to belief, Zacchaeus was probably Jewish based on how Jesus talked to him. Zacchaeus, in offering to give half his possessions to the poor and pay back four times the amount, may have been referencing Exodus 22:1. Whoever steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. Zacchaeus knew the scriptures, he knew the rules, he knew what he had done, and he went to repay. Despite all of this, Jesus opened with a sense of belonging. He didn't call out the behavior. He didn't call out the failed belief. Zacchaeus, come down. I'm coming to your house. Everyone around knew about the man's behavior and belief, and Jesus offered belonging. And from that belonging, from that radically inclusive invitation from Jesus, Zacchaeus was invited to assess his beliefs and behaviors and create change. Jesus was this whirlwind of invitation and change. Regardless of which group he's connecting to, you see this wild invitation as people are invited into life-giving relationships. And you know what's fascinating to me? Societally, that view of Jesus has never changed. Jesus still polls really well today. But when you compare how Jesus polls today to societal views on Christianity, pastors, and churches, there is a stark difference. There are hundreds of books written on the topic. I have a few photos to show up here, but in general, for the last 2,000 years, Jesus has polled really well. And while there's a notable difference between how people of faith and people who don't have a faith look at Jesus, Jesus continues to be an anchor that people look at in our society. Comparatively, however, when you put him next to any other facet of Christianity, it's a stark difference in how people see it. Jesus trends really high, while other areas trend really low. Throw up a first slide. In 2022, Pew Research did surveys on a few topics, which Barna has put in some nice, neat graphs for us. Again, there are hundreds of books written on this. I'll give a few seconds to take a look at it. Most important thing to point out, the purple line is this question to Christians. The gray line is this question to those of no faith. The orange is other faith. Give you just a second to look at it. We can keep that up for a few. As you can see, Jesus is doing really well up here. Even among those of no faith, he's still trending at 40%. As you continue to look down the list, you can see the numbers begin to drop, particularly when you look at the no faith category, which is where I'm going to pay attention. It's at the bottom of the four lines. The Bible down at 28%, Christianity down at 21%, which is fascinating because Jesus was at 40, but the religion that he oversees, that he's a part of, is at half that. Church is at 22%, pastors and priests at 18%. You can see it keeps dropping. So why is that? Why does Jesus consistently poll so high and other areas poll so low? In fact, if you continue to look at studies that have come out in the last few months, Jesus' numbers are actually on the rise in our culture. The rest are not doing as well. There was another question asked in this survey, and it was about what causes people to doubt Christianity. People were allowed to choose multiple answers, and there are a number of different data points for this. I have a slideshow in the top 5 for each category. Throw it up for a second. Again, Christians, people of other faith, and people of no faith. You'll notice there are a few things that show up on multiple. Conflict in the world. On 2 of them is, how can one religion explain everything? But amongst Christians and other faith and no faith, hypocrisy ranks really high. Jesus didn't make the top 5 on any of these lists. In fact, he's not on the decline. What is it that makes Jesus, a man who never shied away from truth, who said things like, I am the way, the truth, and the life, nobody gets to the Father except through me, it's actually a narrow path, there's only one way, it is not subjective truth, there are not a lot of answers, it's just me. At the same time, saying things like, let me come to your house today, what makes him trend so well right now? I think we can begin to guess at some answers. I had the opportunity to connect with Tom Morris, one of our founding pastors here at Discovery this week, about Discovery's initial formation. How did we start? And this is a mix of paraphrase and direct words here. I am heavily editorializing, so if there's anything here that bothers you, I just added it probably. Sorry, Tom. In the early days, Discovery's founding pastor and church planner, Tim Daly, was heavily influenced by the 90s model of what is called seeker-sensitive church. In this model, the church offered a Sunday morning format that was focused specifically on the unchurched, removing elements from the traditional service format that were unclear, confusing, or exclusive to people who are unfamiliar with church practice. These churches often offered other services and programming specifically for believers, including a Wednesday evening service that included more traditional or overtly churchy elements like communion, traditional worship, or intercessory prayer. The model recognized that Sunday morning was still the best time to connect people with God due to legacy societal rhythms, and church programming was not capitalizing on that opportunity. It was also a sacrificial model, asking believers to give up their preferences for the unchurched coming into the room. And at Discovery, we explored some of what that would look like in our context, but we felt it needed some changes. For one, we weren't interested in a faith tradition that didn't have some intellectual substance. We were also pretty big on the language of discovery and exploration and being on a journey together. And as we continue to lean into this belong before you believe language, we continue to push on the fact that we have to stand on truth and what God says. And when all that comes together, this may feel uncomfortable. Toward this end, the earliest membership covenant contained four promises people had to agree with to be a member of this church. I promise to maintain a teachable spirit. I promise to maintain relational integrity. I promise to maintain organizational loyalty. And I promise to maintain a servant's heart. Each of these promises had paragraph attached, but these were the main points. Within this, if you were a devoted follower of Christ or somebody checking out the claims of Christ and trying things out, if you could agree to these four things, we could move forward together. It's part of why you see communion happen the way it does here, why serving happens the way it does here, and we'll talk more about that in a second, and how membership works here. If you're willing to consider the claims of Christ and walk forward together, we're excited to recognize a little bit of the discomfort and the mess. We're excited to extend an invitation for anyone to belong and belong deeply here. And the beliefs we hold to are a deep truth. And if you're willing to recognize that those truths are important here, just like they were to Jesus, then you can belong here as you explore what that means for you. See, all of this is centered around the idea that evangelism, sharing the gospel, telling people about faith, doesn't just happen outside of our walls. It absolutely happens inside of our walls too. But at the same time, discipleship, the growing in faith, the learning, the deepening in faith, it doesn't just happen in our walls. It happens outside our walls too. Because as we watch Jesus, he evangelized in his sermons and in homes and next to lakes and in crowds, and he discipled in sermons and in homes and next to lakes and in crowds. And within all that, he never shied away from truth, and people loved him. And today, people love him. So where do we go with that? Well, first, I want to acknowledge the line I keep using over and over again that I call the curse of the suburbs. There is a general expectation in the suburbs that when you show up, that things are okay, that you keep things close to the chest, and there's lots of smiles, and there's lots of working through things, but only with a very small, trusted group of people. This happens in suburbs all over the world. And it's fascinating when I look at the difference between the two jobs that I worked. The job with those students who were behaviorally pretty rough, where physicality was good so that I could be safe. Their behavior was really rough. They belonged. We had this youth pastor who asked if he could start serving at this nonprofit. John, just an amazing guy. And he served for about 3 months. People started asking what he did, and he said he was a youth pastor. And they said, oh, can we go to church with you? Soon it was 2, 3, 8, 20 kids coming to his youth group, coming to learn about Jesus, coming to learn about this faith that was welling up inside of them, and it was explosive. It was beautiful to watch. Their faith spread like wildfire, and they were loud about it. It was so exciting. When I came to Discovery, that faith journey looked quite a bit different. faith and questions were kept a lot closer to the vest and were much more internal. And while it was still very real, those conversations were multi-year things where students and families worked it out a lot more tightly knit. I learned that in my last job, pointing to Jesus sparked quick conversations, and here pointing to Jesus sparked thoughts and questions and a lot of processing. And it wasn't that belief wasn't there, it was just expressed very differently. I learned that relationships matter a lot here, and that it might take 2, 3, 4 years to get to the heart of things with students and adults. But once you had invested the time and were trusted, that's when I started to learn that when it came to the behaviors and sins of people here at Discovery, we actually weren't all that different from the people I used to work with. A lot of it was just a matter of presentation. It's really easy to make a judgment call about somebody when their life looks like a mess, when they say stupid things, when they do stupid things. It's harder to make a judgment call about somebody when we're trained to look like we have it all together. And there are parts of our lives that we'll never show 99% of people, and some of those parts are a mess and they're broken. And I use the words we and us very intentionally because I'm a part of that. I often make the joke that if you compare your marriage and your kids to what I post about my marriage and my kids on Facebook, you will always lose. Like, we don't post our fights. We don't post the junk. We just post the good pictures right before the yelling starts happening. And I'm not alone in that. Belonging before believing requires that we don't take what we see others do and what we hear them say as somehow less deserving than what we know of ourselves. You may have seen some of the artwork that we have in the lobby. One of them is this silo. This is not intended to look like something to compete with or a ladder to climb or a place to judge yourself versus others. No, it's actually meant to normalize. You see, this first chunk of the silo, this bottom part, is indicative of someone's introduction to faith and the early steps in their faith journey. As you look closely, you can also see percentages on here. These percentages indicate the rough percentage of Christians at each area of their faith journey. Most people tend to get somewhere around the middle of the silo in their life. And the way you measure your worth isn't for every person here to graduate to the very top or compare where you are to others. No, this is just an example of the Christian life. This is descriptive, not prescriptive. If you're in that first set of doubt, that's normal. If you've been in the same place for a decade, that's normal. And if you feel stuck, and you're looking for ways to get unstuck, that's normal. And maybe this will give you some ideas, but the goal here isn't just for everyone to climb and feel guilty if they're not climbing. And if we just judge people by behavior and outside appearance, it's so easy to miss that all of us are on this journey, no matter who we are. Because for someone whose behavior and outside appearance may not seem great, or for someone whose theology doesn't seem to fit yours, or the way they talk just gets under your skin, or the beliefs they hold just seem so wrong, God wants them to belong and have a place in his church. And for those of us whose behavior looks so good, and we keep it together so well, and nobody would guess the crap that we're going through, the crap we do, the sins we hold, because it would be the worst thing ever to put that out for others to see, we know that our behavior is not always in alignment with what we wish it was or what it should be. And many of us are good at hiding it because it can feel like we have to. Discovery aims to be a church where you can belong before you believe, regardless of junk, regardless of behavior, regardless of where you are in your faith journey, because we seem to see Jesus offering that over and over again. Functionally, this means that if you belong here, we want you in the game. There's an idea that you might belong and then kind of sit in the sidelines till you have it figured out. We just functionally don't believe that. We believe that when you belong, you should be a part of it. You should be in community. You should have people. You should feel free to serve. You should feel free to jump into things. You should feel free to be a part. I have a good friend who is a German Methodist pastor. She came to Discovery and saw someone on stage leading us through communion. And after service, she had a few questions for me. She said, "Oh, was that one of your pastors?" I said, "No." She goes, "Oh, was that an elder or a deacon?" I said, "No." "Oh, is that somebody who you've ordained?" I said, "No." They said, "Well, then who was that?" I said, "Oh, that's one of our volunteers who leads us through communion. It's a member of our church." And she said, "Well, then how can they pass out the elements?" Functionally for her, communion is handled by people in authority because of the sanctity of the communion elements. For us, communion is presented from the stage by a priesthood of believers in our church, which is anyone who professes faith in Jesus because of the sanctity of the elements. We believe all are welcome to the table. If you belong here, jump into the game. As I start to wind down, I'll invite the worship team back up. I have so many stories I could end with here. The sermon's already going on longer than normal. I could share about the founder of the Arab American Friendship Center in Broomfield, New York, a young Muslim woman adopted by a local church in Brooklyn who gave her life to Christ as they surrounded her with love. Behavior and beliefs were not there. She belonged. She knows Jesus. I could share a dozen more stories about the nonprofit I worked at and this youth pastor extended love over and over and over again and changed the lives of people despite some pretty rough behavior. I could share stories about things that happen here. I could share stories about adults in the room right now who've had this experience of love and acceptance, and I could share stories of adults in here who've had this experience of dismissal and ridicule and not finding a place they belong and being afraid to speak. I could share stories about online interactions or interactions on a Sunday morning or a retreat that just don't fit the sense of belonging, and you could too. You all just have as many stories as I do. Here at Discovery, you can belong before you believe. We intentionally believe that evangelism happens inside and outside our walls, and discipleship happens inside and outside our walls. And as I look at the reception that Jesus gets, I think it's because Jesus walked into every single interaction with every single person he met, regardless of where they were, regardless of what they believed, regardless of what they did, and he said, "You have value, and I want you to know that you are made in the image of God and for a relationship with God. He made you, he loves you, and he desperately wants a relationship with you. And as much as the world offers all these different truths, there is only one way to heaven, and it's through my Father." That stance was so freaking attractive that 2,000 years later, people still love him. Here at Discovery, because we blur the line, that means that when church ends here in about 20 minutes, we don't believe church is over. We actually believe that's the beginning. We think church continues when you walk outside, when you go out to eat, when you take your kids to school, when you show up at work, when you post online, when you interact with people whose lifestyles and opinions just get under your skin, and there are plenty. That's church. It's an opportunity to open with belonging. I think the thing that changes some of those numbers we showed earlier is this idea of church being a hospital and being a place where you know we show up not knowing what we're doing. You know that people are sick, but you also know that every interaction starts with an invitation for healing and belonging, regardless of belief and behavior. I can't question what would have happened to Zacchaeus if Jesus had opened with fire and brimstone. But I know what happened with Zacchaeus when he opened with belonging. It was life-changing. As a church, you can belong before you believe here, and that extends beyond these walls. You're an ambassador to this way of living. And man, I just have this prayer that when people take these kind of polls, they have an answer, and then they have a discovery answer. Because they know this is a safe place to go and ask questions and argue and figure it out, and that just is good. Here you can belong before you believe. Let's pray. Hey, God. Hey, man, first and foremost, I want to thank you for John Horner, extending invitation to kids who we're going to break things, and we're going to fight, and so desperately need the love of Jesus. And God, I want to pray for just a crappy, crappy time right now. And tumultuous and heavy and hurt. God, I want to pray for a political divide that just keeps getting bigger and bigger with people on both sides casting stones. And God, I want to pray for the people that all of us know who just get under our skin and just bother us. And we can't imagine how someone thinks that way. And God, I just pray that we can start looking at them like they have value. Which doesn't mean agreeing. It doesn't mean accepting. But God, we fully know that you created us to be with you. And you see our value. Jesus, I love that people love you. And I want to be the best ambassador for that. God, thanks for a church that gets to try things out. Thanks for a place that no matter what you've done or what's been done to you, you're welcome. God, thanks for a place you can belong before you believe. And thanks for modeling for us. God, thanks. Amen. If you're able, will you stand and join us as we continue in worship?